If you turn, please, to Psalm 49. Psalm 49. This is a wisdom psalm, and I want to read this psalm as we begin tonight. Psalm 49. The superscription reads, for the choir director, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Then we come into the psalm. Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth will speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart will be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will express my riddle on the harp. Why should I fear in days of adversity, when the iniquity of my foes surround me, even those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches? No man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him, for the redemption of his soul is costly, and he shall cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. He sees that even wise men die, and the stupid and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Their inner thought is that their houses are forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They've called their lands after their own names. But man in his pomp will not endure. He's like the beasts that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words. Selah. As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Selah. Do not be afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his honor is increased. For when he dies, he'll carry nothing away. His glory will not descend after him. But while he lives, he congratulates himself. And though men praise you when you do well for yourself, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They shall never see the light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beast that perish. Now, if you turn, please, to the book of Ecclesiastes, this wisdom book that we are presently reading and surveying, a book that Solomon penned during the time of the United Monarchy. You remember Saul became the king in 1051, and then you have David's son Solomon. And Solomon began to reign, as you recall, in 971 and reigned until his death in 931. So Solomon is the writer of this wisdom book that we know as Ecclesiastes. Now we begin the book with these opening verses. Again, notice what we read in verse 1. The words, the sayings, the reflections of Koheleth, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And here's your basic theme. Vanity of vanities, says Koheleth. And then he repeats it. Vanity of vanities. And then he tells us, all is vanity. And we've emphasized that particular word, vanity, which is emphasized throughout this document of Ecclesiastes, a term that is used, as you recall, 38 times. And basically, it's a word that emphasizes emptiness or simply futility. The NIV translates it meaninglessness. So if I'm reading the NIV, the rendering would be concerning verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. And that is the theme of the entire book. Then we come to this rhetorical question that he poses at the outset in this third verse. He asks, what prophet, and if you recall, we're talking about something that is left over. So we're talking about surplus. We're talking about advantage. We're talking about gain. What profit, what surplus has a man from all of his labor which he has labored? And if you read that particular word that is also emphasized in the book of Ecclesiastes, you're talking about toiling to the point of utter exhaustion, and yet you experience very little fulfillment in what you're doing. So within it would be the idea of grief and misery and frustration and weariness. So it poses the rhetorical question. What profit, what surplus? What do you have when it's all said and done? What profit has a man from all of his toil, which he has toiled under the sun? Referring obviously to a horizontal perspective, thinking only about self and the here and now. And then as you move into the book, you read this over and over again in terms of work, in terms of toil. You build a business, you sacrifice in order to do it, but what do you have when it's all said and done? So if I'm reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, he'll say a lot about work and toil and exhaustion. In chapter 2, as you recall, in verse 18, would you notice it, please? Verse 18 of chapter 2. Yeah, I hated all my labor, which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it to the man that should be after me. And who knows whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet he shall have rule over all of my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. It is futility, emptiness. Then I read, therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and knowledge and equity. Yet to a man that has not labored therein shall he leave it for his inheritance. This is vanity. It is a great evil. For what is man from all of his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he has labored under the sun? For all of his days are sorrows, his travail, grief. Yea, his heart takes no rest in the night. This is emptiness. It's meaningless. It's futility. We come to chapter 3. We read in verse 9, the question again, what profit, what surplus, what does a man have when it's all said and done? What profit has he that works in that wherein he labors? Labors to the point of exhaustion, and yet there's no significance, fulfillment at all in terms of what he's doing. We read that in verse 9. And then I read in verse 10, I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Then I come to chapter 4, and I read this statement in verse 4. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This is vanity. It's a chasing after the wind. I mean, you do something, you're successful, and this person simply envies you in terms of what you've accomplished. You come down to verse 8. He says in chapter 4, verse 8, there's no end of all of his labor, neither is his eye satisfied with riches, neither does he say, for whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? I mean, he never pauses and stops and asks himself, what is he doing? And then he says at the end of verse 8, this is vanity, it's futility, this is a sore travail. Then we come to chapter 5. And we read in verse 10, "He that loves silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase." This is also vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? And then this statement, "The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep." Now think about work. You think about trying to be successful and doing all of these things. And then what do you have left over? I read a very interesting book called The Speechwriter. It is by Barton Swaim. And he was the communications officer and speechwriter for Mark Sanford when he was governor of South Carolina. And he was his communication officer and speechwriter from 2007 to 2010. And if you remember Mark Sanford, he's the one who was hiking on that Appalachian Trail and couldn't find him. And he was in Argentina with his mistress. You remember the governor of South Carolina? Mark Sanford. And it's very interesting to read the words of this individual who worked for him. Now, I want you to listen to his words as he writes this in The Speechwriter. He refers to Catherine Zuckert, her essay on Tom Sawyer. And Zuckert said this, "People like Tom Sawyer serve others not for the sake of the others. They serve because they glory in receiving glory. We should reward such people with the fame they so desire, if and when they perform real public services. But," she said, "we should not trust them." And then this writer says, "I feel the force of that last sentence now. We go badly wrong when we trust them." And then he writes this, "Before I went to work for the governor, I thought he was one of the right people." And he was. He did what he said he was going to do. He took his duty seriously. He behaved himself in public with charm and decorum. He did not fear criticism. He had realistic views of what government could and couldn't accomplish. He was everything a politician should be, a politician in the best sense of that word, if he has a best sense. After 2 or 3 weeks of working for him, although, I knew something was wrong. It wasn't that I thought he should have been the same thoughtful political leader in private that he was in public. The difference between public facade and reality is a valuable and inevitable one. Rather, I found it unnerving to discover such a stark difference between the personality he presented to the public and the one to which he subjected the staff." I mean, if you read what he has to say, he will go on and on in talking about the staff and what the staff thought about him. Now listen to his words. He talks about when the governor would call him on the phone. Sometimes the conversations were brutal. He would discover the unsatisfactory nature of the talking points 4 minutes before he arrived at the event. After a year or so working for him, these calls became a routine and they lost their sting. At 4 minutes before an event was to begin, you'd wait for the phone to ring. When it rang, you'd prepare to answer his questions as best you could. Maybe you had written coat and tie as the appropriate attire and he'd arrived to find everyone dressed casually. Maybe you had neglected to indicate whether or not he was speaking first. It mattered. If he spoke first, what he said should be more important. If third or fourth, less so. Maybe he wanted to know some vital fact about the group he was about to address, whether they'd supported his tax plan the year before, or whether they were mostly middle-class activist types or wealthy donor types, and that fact wasn't properly denoted in the talking points. If he called you directly, it was bad. But I got better at handling him. Once he was about to walk into an event announcing a large investment by the Heinz Company. I'd given him 4 or 5 possibilities. He hated them all. "Tell me something interesting," he was almost shouted into the phone. but I couldn't think of anything else to say about the making of ketchup. Then, as if by inspiration, I remembered a joke I used to tell in school. Okay, I said, how about this? A few statistics for you. Did you know that according to two major studies conducted at Yale and Oxford universities, over half of all cases of heart disease could have been prevented by the simple expedient of consuming one tomato a week? That's not true, he said. You've got that wrong, but go on. Did you know furthermore that a modest increase in one's consumption of tomato phosphate, an ingredient found in Heinz ketchup and steak sauce, can cut your risk of colon cancer by 60%? That's stupid, he said. Where are you getting this? And did you know finally that approximately 91% of statistics are made up on the spot? There was a long pause. That's good. I like that. I said it should get some laughs. By the way, I made up tomato phosphate. I don't even know what that is. But he already hung up the phone. Now, he says this. Now, listen to his words. For weeks at a time, I drive to work in the morning nervous to the point of vomiting. I wasn't worried about any one thing. It was everything. Almost every day threatened to produce some new debacle, an oversight or a blunder that would provoke the governor to wonder with inarticulate rage how someone could do such a moronic thing. I'd find myself longing for a job as a liquor store cashier or a mailman or a pizza delivery guy, some inconspicuous functionary who had no connection with allegedly important things and allegedly important people. I remember there was a middle-aged man who worked for the State House maintenance crew. One of his duties, or maybe his only duty, was to make sure the building's light bulb still worked. I'd see him wandering around the State House, looking up at the various light fixtures. Sometimes I'd see him at the top of a ladder changing a bulb. He'd come into the press office, look up at the lights, satisfied that they're all working, walked out. He always wore a tattered New York Mets baseball cap. He didn't seem anxious. I wanted to be him. Now, I'm reading the statement here in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and I'm reading the statement here in verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. So you work for the governor? You're a speechwriter for the governor? Surely, read speechwriter, he said it was absolutely horrendous. So I'm reading the statement here in terms of work and in terms of trying to be successful. Now look at the statement as you read it in verse 13. Chapter 5, 13. There's a sore evil which I've seen under the sun. Namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish by an evil adventure. He begets a son. There's nothing in his hand. As he came forth out of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. You see what he says? He was successful. He had built this business. He had resources. He made an investment, but it wasn't a wise investment. And as a result, he lost everything. Verse 13, there's a sore evil which I've seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish by evil adventure. He begets a son. There's nothing in his hand because he's lost it all in terms of this investment. The world's largest hedge fund is Bridgewater Associates. And they were bullish on invested in China. But the founder of that hedge fund has changed his mind. And he's recently said, our views about China have changed. There are now no safe places to invest. I mean, you think that there's security and you think there's safety here, but there really isn't. So you think this is a good investment, but it's not. And you lose it all. Then I read verse 16, chapter 5. Here's another one. This also is a sore evil. You have the one in verse 13, but now you have another one. This also is a sore evil. That at all points, just as he came, so shall he go. And then he raises the question. What profit has he that has labored for the wind? What do you have when it's all said and done? You built this company. You've networked, strategized. You've done all of this. And you've left it to an heir. You squandered it all. You never pause to just think, why am I doing all of this? And then you invest and you lose it all. But regardless, just as you came with nothing, that's the way you're going to leave. You're going to leave with nothing. So then he comes to chapter 6 and we read the opening two verses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is heavy upon men. A man to whom God has given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wants nothing for his soul of all that he desires, yet God gives him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eats it. This is vanity. This is an evil disease. I've known individuals who owned restaurants, really nice restaurants, but they couldn't eat at the restaurants because of physical problems. So here they have. They can do whatever they want to do. But physically, they're not able to do it. That's verse 2 of chapter 6. A man to whom God has given riches, wealth, and honor so that he wants nothing for his soul of all that he desires, yet God gives him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eats it. This is vanity. It's an evil disease. So you come back to the question that's raised in chapter 1, verse 3. When it's all said and done, and you've toiled to the point of exhaustion, what do you have? What surplus? What advantage? What gain do you have if everything that you do is under the sun? It's for me and for time. And then he comes back and raises the same statement in chapter 3 and verse 9. What profit is he that works and that wherein he labors? What do you have when it's all said and done? Specifically when you think about what all of us face, and that is death. Now look at the words of Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Look at verse 13. Chapter 2, verse 13. Then I saw that wisdom excels foolishness as far as light excels darkness. I mean, it's far better to be wise than to be a fool, but look at what he says. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happens to them all. One event? One event? Then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it happens even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said to my heart, this also is emptiness. This is vanity. For there's no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dies the wise man like the fool? So you understand that wisdom is far better than folly. But regardless of your wisdom, you're going to die just like the fool. So when you evaluate it, why does it really matter? Then I come to his words in chapter 3. Look at what he says about death. Verse 19. For that which befalls the sons of men befalls beast. Even one thing befalls them. As the one dies, so dies the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man has no preeminence above a beast. For all is vanity. All go to one place. All are of the dust. All turn to dust again. Who knows the spirit of man that goes upward and the spirit of the beast that goes downward to the earth? I mean, it's the reality of death. Then you come to chapter 8 and we read this in verse 7. For he knows not that which shall be. Who can tell him what it shall be? There's no man that has power over the spirit to retain the spirit, neither has he power in the day of death. And there is no discharge in that war, neither will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. Then I come to chapter 9, and I read in the second verse. All things come alike to all. There's one event to the righteous, to the wicked, to the good, to the clean, to the unclean, to him that sacrifices, to him that sacrifices not. As is the good, so is the sinner. He that swears is he that fears an oath. And the event, of course, is the event of death. Then you come to chapter 9, you read verse 11 and 12. I returned, saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. For man also knows not his time, as the fish that are taken in an evil net, as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it, namely death, falls suddenly upon them. Now listen to the words of Pascal, who lived in the 17th century. We know so little about ourselves, he writes, that many people think they're going to die when they're quite well, and many think they're quite well when they're on the point of death, not sensing the approach of fever or the abscess ready to form. No one knows when death is going to strike. No one knows. And you know what he says twice in this book? The days of our life are like a shadow. They're like a shadow. He says in chapter 6 and verse 12, who knows what is good for man in this life? All the days of his vain life which he spends like a shadow. Or as I read it in chapter 8 and verse 13, he uses the same metaphor. He shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days which are like a shadow. So we're here. We're doing all of these things. We're working. Nothing but frustration and futility. We face death. All of us face death. We try to push it out of our minds, but it's absolutely here. And then when you consider our life, it is so brief. It's like a shadow. We're here and it's so brief. I mean, think about it. You've got your monument in a cemetery and you've got the date of your birth and the date of your death and you've got that little dash between the date of birth and the date of death, and that dash is our life here. I mean, it is so brief. And we're always right there. Death looms. We never know when it's going to happen. So Pascal writes this. One needs no great sublimity of soul to realize that in this life there's no true and solid satisfaction, that all of our pleasures are mere vanity, that our afflictions are infinite, and finally that death, which threatens us at every moment, must in a few years infallibly face us with the inescapable and appalling alternative of being annihilated or wretched throughout eternity. Nothing can be more real or more dreadful than that. Let's put on a boldest face as we like. That is the end awaiting the world's most illustrious life. Let's ponder these things and then say whether it's not beyond doubt that the only good thing in this life is the hope of another life. But if you don't have that and you think about only the here and now and only self and you think about how brief this life is, then what's the purpose of it? What's the significance? Because we're all facing death. So Pascal says it like this. Imagine a number of men in chains, all under sentence of death, some of whom are each day butchered in the sight of the others. Those remaining see their own condition and that of their fellows, and looking at each other with grief and despair, await their turn. This is an image of the human condition. He writes, we run heedlessly into the abyss after putting something in front of us to stop us seeing it. We don't want to see it. We don't want to think about it. We push it out of our minds. But it's there, and it's a reality. So you read Arnold Toynbee. Man alone has foreknowledge of his coming death. Possessing this foreknowledge has a chance, if he chooses to take it, of pondering over the strangeness of his destiny. He has at least a possibility of coping with it, since he's endowed with the capacity to think about it in advance and to face it and to deal with it in some way that is worthy of human dignity. I mean, we're going to die. Apart from the Lord's coming, we're going to die. And it's all around us. Worldwide, there are almost 2 people that die every second. There are almost 107 people that die every minute. 6,390 every hour. 153,000 every day. 56 million people die every year. Worldwide. In the United States, every 14 seconds, someone dies. 6,171 every day. 187,714 every month. Over 2,252,000 every year. We push it out. We don't think about it. We don't want to think about it. But this is reality. So we're working, we're doing all of these things. But death is always there. Death is looming. So what's the point? It seems so meaningless. It seems so futile. That's what he says. The whole of it's futile. And then he says, if you think about what you have when this life is over, what do you have? What do you have when it's all said and done? Pascal talks about these various assumptions, and he talks about various ones, but the only right one is this. If it's certain that we shall not be here for long, and uncertain whether we shall be here even 1 hour, this is the right assumption. If it's certain that we shall not be here for long, and uncertain whether we shall be here even 1 hour, we have no idea what's going to happen. So we look at this life, we recognize, we work, but there's no real satisfaction in that, not ultimate satisfaction, and then we know the reality of death. And then we look at this world in which we live, and this world is so bad. It is so evil and corrupt. So you raise it, I wonder what happened. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Look at what he says in verse 29. Chapter 7, verse 29. Lo, this only have I found. Now look. God made man upright. What happened? But they sold out many inventions. You had the fall of Genesis 3. Original sin. An actual sin. God made man upright. God made man right. We have in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. But all of that collapsed in Genesis 3. They have sought out, he says in verse 29, many inventions. Now you're dealing with sin. Chapter 7, look at verse 20. There is not a just man upon earth that does good and doesn't sin. Everyone sins. So I read chapter 8. Look at the statement, verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Since an individual does something bad and there seems to be no consequence, he thinks he can do it with impunity. He thinks he can do it with no consequence at all. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Look at chapter 9. Look at verse 3. This is an evil among all things that are done under the sun. There's one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart, while they live. Now look at that phrase. the heart of the sons of men full of evil. Madness is in their heart while they live. We talk about causes of crime, poverty, racism, social alienation, lenient judges. How about this? Chapter 8, verse 11, nothing happens. They think they can get away with it. Chapter 9, verse 3, the heart of the sons of men full of evil, madness is in their heart while they live. So you talk about sin. You talk about original sin, actual sin. You're talking about corruption, and it's pervasive. Look at chapter 3, and notice what he says in chapter 3, verse 16. Move our soul unto the sun, the place of judgment. Wickedness was there. The place of righteousness. Iniquity was there. I mean, you would expect in a court of law that it would be right. I said in my heart, verse 17, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in my heart, for the sake of, because of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, that they might see that they themselves are beasts, the animals. Then we come to chapter 4, verse 1. So I returned. I considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold the tears of such as were oppressed. They had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors, there was power. But they had no comforter. The oppressor had all the power, and the oppressed, no one was there to help them. He says it twice. They had no comforter. They had no comforter. Then we come to chapter 5, and we read verse 8. If you see the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in the province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regards, and there is higher than they. It's the system. It's the way it works. They protect themselves. It's all corrupt. I read I've been following this, and I don't know if you've been following this prosecutor in Argentina, Alberto Nisman. And it's incredible in terms of what happened to this man. He was a career prosecutor in Argentina. And he electrified Argentina by an accusation. He charged at the president, Cristina Kirchner, had orchestrated a secret plan to scuttle the investigation of the bloodiest terrorist attack in Argentina's history, which was back in 1994, when there was a bombing at that Jewish center and 85 people died. And he believed that the president was involved in it. And what's interesting about this? This man, he died. He died the night before he was to present his evidence. He died that night by a gunshot wound to his head. They found him in his apartment the night before he was to present the evidence. Now listen to this comment from an investigator who's been researching all of this in terms of his death. 2 years after taking the case, Nisman produced an indictment. In the course of 801 pages, he charged 7 Iranian officials, including the former president, Rafsanjani, and also indicated Hezbollah's senior military commander. The decision to carry out the attack was made not by a small splinter group of extremist Islamic officials, Nismad wrote, but was extensively discussed and ultimately adopted by a consensus of the highest representatives of the Iranian government. Drawing on the testimony of Iranian defectors, he wrote that the decision was made on August 14, 1993, at a meeting of the Committee for Special Operations, which included the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei. And he believes that the President of Argentina was involved in a cover-up in terms of Iran's involvement. And it is absolutely unbelievable to read this. I mean, when you talk about his death, there are so many things that are unexplained. He did not commit suicide. The president said initially that he committed suicide, but then she backtracked. And when you look at the evidence, he did not commit suicide. He was killed. This investigator said, in the days before Nisman died, he believed that the Iranians were coming for him. When he met a congresswoman, he told her that he overheard wiretap conversations of Argentine military intelligence officers saying they had passed his personal information to agents of Iran on orders from Kirchner. Nisman said the Iranians knew about him, about the investigation, with details about his family, about his daughters, about all the movements of his daughters. He died the night before he used to present this evidence against the president of Argentina. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible to read it. I've heard in this one. I don't know if you've been following this. I mean, you're covering up. You expect justice. You think you're going to get justice, but you don't get it. Now I read another one. This is absolutely incredible. These were two individuals in the Interior Ministry in Russia. And they were generals. And they were involved in anti-corruption. And they believed that they had the support of the president, Putin. But they got too close to various individuals. And it wasn't good for these two individuals. Sugaprov, Kolodnikov. And they believed that the president was going to safeguard them. But it didn't happen. They were arrested. And it's unbelievable when you talk about the corruption of what happened and what he had to say, this one fella, to his wife. And they wanted him to confess, and he refused to confess. He didn't have any shoes, so they worked it out where his wife brought shoes to him. And then they used that as a pretense to go after his wife. According to the article, almost a month later, prison authorities alleged a drug-sniffing dog had found a secret hiding place in the sneakers, and they were being sent for chemical analysis. He and his defense team immediately understood that his wife, Victoria, who had passed him the sneakers, was now under threat of serious legal prosecution. So they were going to now go after his wife. They were going to go after his kids. And he committed suicide. But it's a question whether he committed suicide. I mean, you read this in chapter 5, verse 8. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in the province, marvel not at the matter. He that is higher than the highest regards and to be higher than they. I mean, it's a system. It's the way it works. I mean, it's just absolute corruption. So when you look at all of this, you would have to say there is evil everywhere. It permeates. And it's very difficult to discard it. I read the words of David Bradley. He owns the media company that publishes The Atlantic. And he grew up as a Christian scientist, believing God created man as a perfect being, disease, death, pain, evil, all imaginary afflictions that could be prayed away. Well, he's turned away from that, but there are certain things that haven't left him, and some changes have taken place in his mind. He said, I remain deeply sympathetic to Christian Science, but as to evil, I've changed my mind. There is evil in the world. There is evil. And we all know it. And Ecclesiastes talks about it. And this comes from a king. We think of our little 911. You know, that was first basically the first call, 911 call, was back in 1968. In 1999, Congress mandated 911 to be the national emergency number. So if you talk about the emergency response system, it goes back to 1968. It was mandated in 1999. And you know what's interesting about it? There are 27,000 calls approximately to 911 every hour. 27,000 calls. I mean, there's danger. There's all kinds of things that happen. And that is what we read here in Ecclesiastes. So I think about work, I think about death, I think about sin, I think about corruption. And when you think about it, he says there's injustice. They're crooked politics. They're incompetent leaders. They're people, guilty people allowed to commit more crimes. And that's what he talks about. And remember, he's writing this 3,000 years ago. And yet we still have the problem today. Now you know what Pascal said? Pascal says, everyone wants happiness and everybody wants certainty. They said this back in the 17th century. Everybody is after happiness and everybody is after certainty. But there's no happiness and there's no certainty here. He writes, we're incapable of not desiring truth and happiness and incapable of either certainty or happiness. But people want it. I want happiness and I want certainty. Can't have it. So what's our response? You know what our response is? We become indifferent or we seek some kind of distraction. Now, Pascal talked about this in great length back in the 17th century. We become indifferent to what's going on, or we have something to distract us. We don't want to think about realities. Because if you think about realities, you're stuck in Ecclesiastes, and you realize everything is futile here. Everything is meaningless here. My work, thinking about death, thinking about sin and corruption, all of these things all around us. So you look at life, and life seems to be so meaningless. Men consider, well, the basic fact about human experience is not that it's a tragedy, but that it's a bore. It's not that it's predominantly painful, but it's lacking in any sense. So you look around and you see all of these things and you wonder what's it all about. We work. We're on this treadmill. We don't know when, but we could die at any moment. There's corruption all around us. Not only do we deal with it within ourselves, but it's all around us. There's exploitation. There is incredible sin. I read a terrible book about a fella in international finance. He worked for Goldman Sachs before all of this happened. He was in New York, he was in London, he was in Hong Kong. And he talks about investment bankers. He talks about what they all do. From my experience, he said, Wall Street generally attracts people with a certain mentality. It then takes those people, breaks them down, molds them to suit its singular purpose, making money. End justifies the means. You'll learn that very quickly. End justifies the means. There's no justice in this world. You learn that very quickly. And then it's interesting because he doesn't really name names. He keeps various individuals' names private. But then you come to the end in his epilogue and he says, most of the people mentioned in this book have moved on to more senior positions at the biggest and most prestigious firms in the world. They're held in high esteem by a society that values wealth and success. They're wielding influence in Washington. They're sitting on the boards of Fortune 500 companies. They're taking communion. They're leading philanthropic initiatives. They're married to your daughters. And when you read it, they are utterly corrupt. In terms of alcohol, in terms of prostitutes, in terms of what they do in these various places. So I turn here and I look at it and I think about what Solomon says here in Ecclesiastes. And he wants me to understand. Have you heard the little statement? Faces along the bar cling up their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. Lest we know where we are. And then this, lost in a haunted wood. Children afraid of the dark who have never been happy or good. Lost in a haunted wood. So if the only thing there is the here and now and me and self and living, then it's all meaningless. It's all futile. You know what country has the highest suicide rate? It's been the highest suicide rate for the past 8 years. 8 straight years. High suicide rate. South Korea. 2012, 39 people per day killed themselves in South Korea. 8 consecutive years, high suicide rate among developed countries. Well, if this is all there is, so you read the statement in verse 2 of chapter 1. Vanity of vanities, that's a Hebrew superlative. Says Kohelet, vanity of vanity, that's a Hebrew superlative. The whole is vanity. Then he raises the question, what gain to a man by all the toil in which he toils under the sun? Seems to be no benefit, doesn't seem to be any profit, no purpose at all, doesn't seem to be anything inherent of significance within what you are doing if it's all lived for the here and now. That's what he says. Dostoevsky was a powerful writer in his day. When he died, thousands of people lined the streets of St. Petersburg to bid him farewell. But he died broke. He was addicted to gambling. Alexander the Great said he conquered the world, couldn't conquer it himself. Alcohol. Michael Jackson? I mean, think about it. How sad. Stephen Hawking? Brilliant mind? Lives in a wheelchair. Communicating with the world by the movement of one finger. If he can even move the one finger now. So, I mean, what's it all about? Well, you read Solomon's words, and Solomon says, how futile to have lived life and really not knowing the key of what it's all about. What a waste to die and yet really not understanding what this life is all about. How sad. How sad is that? And there are a lot of people there. So Pascal will say concerning Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes shows that man without God is totally ignorant and inescapably unhappy. Which is absolutely true. Now, if you go to Psalm 49, Psalm 49 is a very interesting psalm because here is an individual who has made it and he's trusting in his money. His money is his security. But when you read Psalm 49, the psalmist will say, money cannot save you from death. Money cannot be enjoyed forever. Money cannot prevent corruption of the body once you die. Money cannot be taken with you when you die. And you're not going to be able to return and enjoy it once again. So when you read Psalm 49, there's a little statement. You remember the statement? It's repeated twice. It's found in verse 12. Man in his pomp will not endure. He's like the beast that perish. And then it's stated in verse 20. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beast that perish. Now that's the key. When I read verse 12, man in his pomp will not endure, he's like the beast that perish. But here it is, verse 20. Man in his pomp that doesn't have any understanding is like a beast that perish. Which of course tells us we better have understanding what it's all about. And our security is not found in money. Our security is found only in the Lord. So I read about this world in which we live. We'd say it's very dangerous. You think about all the countries that have nuclear capability. Pakistan is estimated to have 120 nuclear bombs. India, 110. Israel, 80. North Korea, about 10. Non-countries have almost 16,000 nuclear weapons. And then if you think about these nuclear weapons in comparison to what happened in 1945, what happened in 1945, that was like a firecracker in comparison to these nuclear weapons that we have today. So I read the words of C.S. Lewis. He was asked during the Second World War what he would think if the Germans got the atom bomb, dropped one on England, and saw it falling right on top of him. If you only had time for one last thought, what would it be? And Lewis replied, he would look up at the bomb, he would stick out his tongue, and he would say, you're only a bomb. I'm an immortal soul. Which is absolutely right. We're all immortal souls. We're here for a brief period of time and we are gone. And the only thing that really matters is, of course, our relationship with Jesus Christ. So let me end with this. Listen to Ravi Zacharias. Some years ago, I was invited to the Orient by a businessman to address a gathering of people called diamond-collared executives. He himself is known to be one of the wealthiest men in his country. In fact, I subsequently realized he's listed by those who make such lists as one of the 10 wealthiest people in the world. When I arrived there, I asked him what had brought him to place his trust in Jesus Christ. Oh, he said, about 18 months ago, I said to my wife, I have everything in life, but I'm still so empty. I do not know where to turn. I believe I need God. His wife supported that yearning with that. They began their search and found their way to Jesus Christ. Nothing dramatic, no big crusade, just a regular attendance at a weekly Bible study group. And they were now in tune with the wealth of a newfound relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's what it's all about. So I read Ecclesiastes, dust off the book and say, this is very relevant for our thinking today. It's not found in my work. It's not found in the here and now. It's not found in me. It's not found in someone else here. It's corruption all around me. I can die at any moment. So what's it all about? He tells us in this book. And I'll come back to it, Lord willing, next week.
because until we recognize that we were made for Him and we were made for eternity, then we're going to be very disillusioned. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we do thank Thee for the book of Ecclesiastes, how real it is. We know that the things that Solomon observed in his own day and time, we see in ours. And we know we can be mesmerized by the things around us, and we can be deceived in thinking that there is meaning and significance in something here. We know, Father, it's all an illusion. There's no truth or reality to this at all. We pray that we would understand what this life is truly about. We thank Thee that we do have the key that unlocks the door, that helps us to understand this. And we just pray, Father, that we would look beyond the here and now, and we would look to Jesus Christ and our relationship with Him, and we would seek to bring glory and honor to Him. So guide us, Lord, in our thinking, and help us, Lord, to be wise people and not utter fools. We again thank Thee for the eternal life that is ours in Jesus Christ. We thank Thee that we know Him now, and we will know Him in an unbelievable way one day when we actually see Him. Make this real to each one of us, we pray, for I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.